prefer tea or coffee? Indie, folk, rock, electronic, I've got it all. Tune in to What's Brewing Tuesdays from 7:30 to 8 a.m. for the freshest Canadian music to pair with your morning brew. Listen in as I chat over a cup of something fresh and talk about my favorite new releases from Canadian artists that I love. Nothing like good music and good coffee to start your day, so tune in to see What's Brewing.
Want to help a kitten in need? Check out local nonprofit Napanee Kitten Rescue, which is dedicated to the rescue, rehabilitation, and adoption of homeless kittens and cats. You can help by fostering, adopting, or donating to this great local charity. This kitten rescue helps furry friends, from bottle baby kittens who lost their mothers to older cats who need to be socialized. Check out NapaneeCommunityKittenRescue.ca for more information.
Hi, this is Ira from Yola Tango. You're listening to CFRC 101.9, Queen's University in Kingston, the birthplace of reggae.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I ask you to have mercy, Mr. President, on those in our communities whose children fear that their parents will be taken away, and that you help those who are fleeing war zones and persecution in their own lands to find compassion and welcome here.
Episcopal Bishop Marianne Edgar Buddy directly challenges President Trump in her sermon at the National Prayer Service Tuesday. We'll hear her remarks and look at why Public Citizen and other groups are suing DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, which is headed by the world's richest man, Elon Musk. We'll also look at the connection between Musk's rise to power and the Supreme Court's decision in Citizen United.
It's largely a function of Musk having poured over $250 million into super PACs last election cycle. And that spending is only possible because of the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Citizens United, which turned 15 this week.
Finally, Ravi Ragbir is back. President Biden granted the immigrant rights leader a pardon a day before he left office.
This has meant a lot for my family and myself because it stops the continued punishment that I have faced throughout the last 2 decades. Where I every day was uncertain because I faced the possibility of deportation.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump's purged several career officials from key positions at the Justice Department, a move critics say will pave the way to weaponize the agency against Trump's enemies. The Washington Post reports at least 15 experienced career staffers across the Justice Department's National Security and Criminal Divisions were removed from their positions and reassigned. Among them, a senior counterintelligence attorney who played a key role in deciding to search Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence to retrieve classified documents. He's reportedly been transferred to a newly created Office of Sanctuary Cities Enforcement. The purge has come as Trump asserted broad presidential authority in his first full day in office, firing the heads of the Transportation Security Administration and the commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard, Admiral Linda Fagan, who in 2022 became the first woman to lead a branch of the U.S. Armed Forces. She was fired as the White House ordered employees in any federal diversity, equity, inclusion, accessibility, or DEI offices to be placed on administrative leave effective immediately. A coalition of 22 Democratic-led states on Tuesday filed a lawsuit in federal court to block President Trump's executive order attempting to end birthright citizenship. The District of Columbia and the City of San Francisco are also plaintiffs in the suit, which followed a similar lawsuit filed by the ACLU. This marks the beginning of what's expected to be mounting litigation against Trump's anti-immigrant agenda. California Attorney General Rob Bonta said Tuesday the order clearly violates the U.S. Constitution's 14th Amendment.
It also violates the Immigration and Nationality Act and flouts more than 125 years, a century and a quarter, of long-standing, well-established precedent set by the U.S. Supreme Court. The president has overstepped his authority by a mile, and we will hold him accountable.
In related news, the Trump administration will allow federal immigration agents to conduct raids at schools, hospitals, and houses of worship, ending a years-long policy that banned ICE, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement, from arresting people at these sites. This all comes as Reuters reports nearly 1,600 Afghan refugees who've been cleared for resettlement in the U.S. have been left in immigration limbo after the Trump administration suspended refugee admissions. Among them are unaccompanied Afghan children hoping to reunite with their families in the U.S., and Afghans who aided the U.S. occupation and now fear they'll be killed or punished by the Taliban government. In the occupied West Bank, at least 10 Palestinians were killed and dozens more injured Tuesday when Israeli forces, backed by helicopter gunships, launched a major offensive on the city of Jenin. Eyewitnesses described seeing bodies in the streets with ambulances blocked from retrieving the dead and wounded. An estimated 2,000 Palestinian families have been displaced by the fighting. This comes after the Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem documented more Israeli settler attacks on Palestinian villages across the occupied West Bank carried out with the full cooperation of Israeli soldiers. Videos shared by B'Tselem appears to show settlers throwing stones and Molotov cocktails at Palestinians in Sinjil, where six Palestinians were injured over the weekend. In another incident, Israeli soldiers shot and killed a 15-year-old Palestinian boy as they escorted rioting settlers through the West Bank town of Sabastia. B'Tselem says the settler attacks are meant to impose a price tag for the Gaza ceasefire deal. On Monday, Palestinian families erupted in celebration as Israel released the first wave of captives from Israeli jails as part of the Gaza ceasefire deal. Of the first 90 Palestinians released, 69 are women, 21 children. Most have been detained without charge under Israel's administrative detention law. Among them is the journalist Rula Hassanein, an editor for the Ramallah-based Watan Media Network. Daughter, whom she last saw 10 months ago when the baby was just 9 months old. She was tried by a military court at Israel's notorious Ofer prison and convicted of incitement after she shared social media posts sympathetic to Palestinians in Gaza. Speaking after her release, Hassanein told the news site Middle East Eye she and other Palestinian women were deprived of food, clothing, and medical care.
There were numerous violations against female prisoners as women. Honestly, it's difficult to even describe them on air or even in private conversations. There was significant infringement of basic rights. Headscarves were removed, strip searches were conducted repeatedly, and there were sudden night inspections. There was repression beyond imagination, a purely oppressive situation.
In Gaza, Israeli forces shot and killed a 12-year-old Palestinian child in the southern city of Rafah on Monday, in what witnesses called a blatant violation of the ceasefire deal. Video of the assault shows Israeli forces opening fire on another person attempting to retrieve the boy's limp body. The UN's Humanitarian Affairs Office says more than 2,400 aid trucks have entered the besieged Palestinian territory since Israel lifted its blockade Sunday when the ceasefire deal took effect. In Israel, a man with a knife stabbed and wounded four people on a Tel Aviv street Tuesday evening before he was shot dead by a civilian at the scene in an attack police are investigating as politically motivated violence. Haaretz reports the attacker was a 29-year-old Moroccan citizen with a U.S. residency card who arrived in Israel 3 days ago. It was the second stabbing in Tel Aviv in just 4 days. In related news, Israel's military chief of staff has resigned over what he said was his failure to prevent the October 7, 2023 attack. Lieutenant General Hatzi Halevi becomes the most senior Israeli figure to resign over failures to prevent Hamas's surprise attack on that day. Halevi led Israel's military campaign that reduced much of Gaza's civilian infrastructure to rubble and massacred over 47,000 people, according to Palestinian officials, who believe another at least 10,000 bodies are trapped beneath the rubble. He's expected to resign fully in March. President Trump's choice to become the next U.S. ambassador to the United Nations refused to say Tuesday whether the Palestinian people have the right to self-determination. New York Republican Congressmember Elise Stefanik made the comments during her confirmation hearing at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, where she confirmed to Maryland Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen that she believes Israel has a biblical right of dominion over the occupied West Bank.
I'm rarely surprised by answers in my office, but I did ask you whether you subscribe to the views of Finance Minister Smotrich.
Smotrich.
This is the Israeli Finance Minister Smotrich and the former National Security Minister Ben-Gvir, who believe that Israel has a biblical right to the entire West Bank. And in that conversation, you told me that, yes, you shared that view. Is that your view today?
Yes.
In more news on Israel, the tech giant Google provided the Israeli military with access to its latest artificial intelligence technology since nearly the beginning of its assault on Gaza. That's according to The Washington Post, which obtained internal documents showing Google directly assisted Israeli military forces despite the company's efforts to publicly distance itself from Israel's national security apparatus. Last year, Google fired dozens of employees with the group No Tech for Apartheid after they demanded Google withdraw from Project Nimbus, a $1.2 billion contract to provide cloud computing services to the Israeli military. Panama's issued a letter to the UN Security Council expressing alarm over President Trump's threats to invade and retake the Panama Canal. This is Panama's president, Jose Raul Molina.
The day I traveled here, I stated my government's position in a statement, rejecting in its entirety everything Mr. Trump said. Firstly, because it was false, and secondly, because the Panama Canal belongs to Panama and will continue to belong to Panama. The Panama Canal was not a concession or a gift from the United States. The Panama Canal came into being in 1914, following a bilateral treaty in 1903 at the dawn of our independence with Colombia.
President Trump's defense secretary nominee, Pete Hegseth, is facing fresh claims of violent and threatening behavior and problems with alcohol abuse. Hegseth's former sister-in-law, Danielle Hegseth, who was married to his brother, said in a sworn affidavit to Senate lawmakers that Hegseth made his second wife, Samantha Hegseth, fear for her safety. The affidavit alleged Samantha Hegseth once had to hide from Pete Hegseth in a closet and that she gave her friends a code word in case she needed help and developed an escape plan. Danielle Hegseth also said she witnessed Pete Hegseth repeatedly scream "no means yes" at a bar in 2013, suggesting men don't need to obtain sexual consent from women. The affidavit was submitted in response to requests from Democratic Senator Jack Reed, who said the background check process for Hegseth, quote, has been inadequate, and this sworn affidavit confirms that fact, he said. Both Pete and Samantha Hegseth have denied these allegations. Leaders of the far-right groups, the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers, were freed from prison Tuesday after President Trump granted full, complete, and unconditional presidential pardons to over 1,500 people involved in the January 6th insurrection. Among those released was Enrique Tarrio, the former leader of the Proud Boys, who'd been serving a 22-year federal prison sentence after he was convicted of seditious conspiracy. Also released Tuesday, former Oath Keepers leader Stuart Rhodes, who spoke to reporters after his 18-year prison sentence was commuted by Trump.
I feel vindicated and validated. Yes, absolutely. Of course, I haven't gotten a pardon yet. I got commutation. But I'm applying for one. I'm pretty positive I'll get one. When they review my case, they'll understand that I was targeted for who I am, not for anything I did.
Capitol rioter Jacob Chansley, whose horned fur hat, face paint, and 6-foot spear made him one of the more recognizable insurrectionists on January 6th, known as the QAnon Shaman, wrote on the social media site X, quote, "Thank you, President Trump. Now I'm going to buy some mother F bleep guns," unquote. Chansley was among a group that broke into the Senate chamber and left a threatening note to then Vice President Mike Pence reading, "It's only a matter of time. Justice is coming," unquote. Most Republican leaders have remained quiet on Trump's pardons. Asked whether he supported or opposed the pardon, Senate Majority Leader John Thune said, quote, "We're not looking backwards, we're looking forward," unquote. Capitol Police officers, many of whom were wounded by the mob Trump incited on January 6, blasted Trump's pardons and commutations. Former Sergeant Aquilino Gunnell called it a, quote, "miscarriage of justice, a betrayal, a mockery, and a desecration of the men and women that risked their lives defending our democracy," he said. And in labor news, unionized Costco employees have authorized a strike set to begin February 1st unless they reach a deal with the mega retailer before their contract expires at the end of the month. The Teamsters said about 18,000 Costco workers are ready to walk off the job at 56 of the company's warehouse stores across five states. Workers are demanding better wages, paid family leave, sick time, and protections against surveillance. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show looking at growing pushback to Donald Trump's sweeping moves to reshape the country. On Tuesday, 24 states and cities sued to block Trump's executive order to end birthright citizenship. The Trump administration's also facing four lawsuits over the formation of DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, a new department headed by the world's richest man, Elon Musk. In a moment, we'll speak to the co-president of Public Citizen, one of the organizations suing over DOGE. But we begin today's show with the words of Episcopal Bishop Marian Edgar Buddy. On Tuesday, she gave the sermon at the inaugural prayer service at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. She directly confronted President Trump, who was sitting nearby with Vice President J.D. Vance.
Let me make one final plea, Mr. President. Millions have put their trust in you. And as you told the nation yesterday, you have felt the providential hand of a loving God. In the name of our God, I ask you to have mercy upon the people in our country who are scared now. There are gay, lesbian, and transgender children in Democratic, Republican, and independent families. Some who fear for their lives. And the people who pick our crops and clean our office buildings, who labor in poultry farms and meat packing plants, who wash the dishes after we eat in restaurants and work the night shifts in hospitals, they may not be citizens or have the proper documentation. But the vast majority of immigrants are not criminals. They pay taxes and are good neighbors. They are faithful members of our churches and mosques, synagogues, wadara, and temples. I ask you to have mercy, Mr. President, on those in our communities whose children fear that their parents will be taken away, and that you help those who are fleeing war zones and persecution in their own lands to find compassion and welcome here. Our God teaches us that we are to be merciful to the stranger, for we were all once strangers in this land. May God grant us the strength and courage to honor the dignity of every human being, to speak the truth to one another in love, and walk humbly with each other and our God. For the good of all people, the good of all people in this nation and the world.
Episcopal Bishop Marian Edgar Buddy addressing President Trump and his family at the inaugural prayer service at the National Cathedral in Washington, as Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance sat in the front pew. Trump was later asked at the White House about her sermon.
What did you think of the service?
What did you think? Did you like it? Did you find it exciting? Not too exciting, was it? I didn't think it was a good service, no. Thank you very much.
Thank you, press.
They can do much better.
President Trump later posted a message about Bishop Marianne Edgar Buddy on a social media platform, Truth Social, writing, quote, "The so-called bishop who spoke at the National Prayer Service on Tuesday morning was a radical left hardline Trump hater. She brought her church into the world of politics in a very ungracious way. She was nasty in tone and not compelling or smart," unquote. Republican Congressman Mike Collins of Georgia posted a message online saying, quote, "The person giving the sermon should be added to the deportation list," unquote. For the record, Episcopal Bishop Marianne Edgar Buddy was born in New Jersey. She served as Bishop of Washington since 2011. Coming up, Public Citizen sues the Trump administration over DOGE, Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency. Stay with us. Garth Hudson, the multi-instrumentalist of the band, died Tuesday at the age of 87. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Trump administration is facing four lawsuits so far over its formation of DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, a new initiative headed by the world's richest man, Elon Musk, who spent over $250 million to help Trump win in November. Trump initially named former Republican presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy to be Musk's co-chair, but Ramaswamy has announced he's leaving the role to run for governor of Ohio. There are reports Musk pushed for Ramaswamy to be ousted from his role. The New York Times reports Musk is likely to be given office space inside the West Wing of the White House, even though DOGE is not an official government department. One of the lawsuits was filed by Public Citizen, along with the American Federation of Government Employees and the State Democracy Defenders Fund. We're joined now by Robert Weissman, co-president of Public Citizen. Rob, if you can start off by just talking about why Public Citizen has joined others in suing over DOGE, and explain even the significance of the word DOGE.
Well, hey, Amy, Juan, it's great to be with you. We sued over this new thing, which is really an advisory committee called DOGE. It's not a government department, to force it to comply with the law. Advisory committees have to follow certain procedures under federal law. They have to have balanced representation. They have to have open meetings, have a charter, be subject to open records law, and so on. There's no sign that this DOGE is doing any of those things. The term DOGE refers to a meme coin, a cryptocurrency that Elon Musk is a fan of. So it's a little bit of a joke, but the joke's on all of us. What DOGE is about is empowering Elon Musk, the world's richest human being, to make recommendations and really drive policymaking in the Trump administration to roll back regulations, the rules that give us clean air, clean water, safe food, fair workplaces, and more, to benefit corporations and to drive a libertarian extremist agenda of cutting government spending primarily on programs to help the poor and vulnerable, including nutrition assistance and Medicaid.
And Robert Weissman, the Public Citizen came up with its own cost-cutting report titled DOGE Delusions. Could you talk about what you're recommending in terms of cost-cutting in government?
Yeah, well, of course, first off, efficiency is not a primary value. The first question is what the government ought to be doing. But we said, okay, you're interested in saving money. That's what you mean by efficiency. We'll play that game. What could the government do to be efficient? not just ideologically driven, not just how to drive corporate profits. And we came up with $500 billion in pretty easy savings. $500 billion every year in Washington, that counts for $5 trillion because we count in 10-year increments. We could save $200 billion if we dealt with excessive drug pricing. Some of that would help taxpayers, some of it would help consumers. We could save $100 billion every year or more by ending privatized Medicare, which is a ripoff of the Medicare system. We could easily cut $200 billion from the Defense Department, the Pentagon budget. So altogether, real quick, $500 billion. More money to be saved by cutting subsidies for oil and gas companies, and on and on. Then we said, well, efficiency doesn't just mean saving money. It should mean raising money efficiently as well. And it would be easy to raise an additional $500 billion against the baseline of the current Trump tax cuts by raising taxes on the rich and corporations. So now we're talking about $1 trillion every year. What should we do with that money? Well, efficiency should also mean making smart public investments. The programs that Musk is targeting, food stamps, early education interventions, and the like, those pay back. We should be doing more of those things because even in dollars and cents terms, even if you don't care about real human beings, just in dollar and cents terms, they pay back. And the most important public investment we can make, if we're just worried about dollars and cents, is making deep and profound investments to address the climate crisis, to reduce the harm we're going to face, and to mitigate the damage that is now going to be unavoidable.
And you talk about Musk, who's been tapped to head this advisory committee. What about the built-in conflict of interest, given all the businesses that Musk has that do that depend on the federal government?
Yeah, they're profound and without parallel. And in fact, I think Musk's role in this government is part of a broader convergence of corporate and government power, corporate and state power, that doesn't really have a parallel in American history, certainly not in the last 100 years. Profoundly dangerous. But when it comes to Musk himself, because he's involved in so many businesses, he has really important interests before huge portions of the government. For example, he wants Twitter, X, to become a payment transmitter. That's like Apple Pay. If it does so, it would be regulated by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Musk has called for the elimination of that bureau. He's called for the elimination of the agency that would regulate his company. He has huge business with the Department of Defense through Starlink. He has huge business at NASA, where he's helped install a buddy to run the agency and is competing with an Amazon-affiliated corporation. He would rather win that competition and have Amazon and Jeff Bezos eliminated from the competition. He is facing significant enforcement actions from the Securities and Exchange Commission. He'll have the ability to influence that. He's got big problems at Tesla with enforcement of auto safety rules against Tesla's self-driving vehicles, and on and on and on. And he's in position now making recommendations for throughout the government to advance his own business interests. And of course, there's every reason to assume he's going to do exactly that.
Now, Rob Weissman, you and your co-president, Public Citizen, asked to be on the advisory committee?
Right. So advisory committees are governed by something called the Federal Advisory Committee Act, FACA. And FACA says that advisory committees have to be fair and balanced. Well, when this so-called DOGE was started, it had two members, Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy, two billionaires. Our position is, we think not controversially, two billionaires does not make a balanced committee. So we recommended ourselves as experts and advocates for consumers and the public interest to offer some balance. We haven't received a response, but the failure of the committee to provide balance is one of the bases of our lawsuit.
Why, Rob Weissman, do you believe that President Trump issued one of his executive orders against EVs when, of course, you've got Musk, who is the head of Tesla?
Well, I think the core, I mean, there's a few reasons. The pr- primary reason is that part of the Trump agenda is to race towards climate apocalypse, to double down on oil, gas, and even coal development, exploitation, and use, and to move away from the advances we've made in renewable energy. Electric cars, obviously an important shift away from oil and gas and towards electricity powered by the sun and wind. The EV program that Biden adopted and helped push through as part of the Inflation Reduction Act was singularly important in helping drive the move towards electric cars. And it's Trump's agenda to do away with all that. Of course, Musk is in the business of selling electric cars. So there's reason to say, well, does this hurt Musk? According to Musk himself, it might cause him some pain, but will cause his competitors in the business more pain. So at the end of the day, it seems he gets competitive advantage out of this move.
I want to bring in our next guest. President Trump's return to the White House comes 15 years to the week after the U.S. Supreme Court issued its landmark Citizens United ruling, which opened the floodgates for billionaires like Elon Musk to pour unlimited money into elections. At Trump's inauguration on Monday, Elon Musk was given a prime seat along with Meta's Mark Zuckerberg, Amazon's Jeff Bezos, Apple's Tim Cook, Google's Sundar Pichai. Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders commented, when the three wealthiest men in America sit behind Trump at his inauguration, everyone understands that the billionaire class now controls our government, unquote. We go now to Brendan Fischer, Deputy Executive Director at Documented, lawyer with expertise in campaign finance and government transparency issues. He has a new article out today in Rolling Stone, headlined Blame the Supreme Court for Elon Musk's power in Trump's administration. Talk about the significance of this week, Brendan, the 15th anniversary of Citizens United. And for people who don't understand what it is, trace the trajectory of the Supreme Court decision right through to the power of Elon Musk in the White House today.
Sure. And thank you for having me, Amy and Juan. So everything that Rob Weissman just described is entirely accurate. And it's a result. Musk's astonishing influence over Trump and this new administration, you know, is not just a result of his right wing celebrity, his personal wealth, his ownership of X. It's largely attributable to Musk having poured over $250 million into the 2024 election cycle. And almost all of that spending would have been impossible before Citizens United. Citizens United struck down limits on quote unquote independent political spending, and it opened the door to super PACs and dark money groups that billionaires like Musk have used to pour this astonishing amount of money into U.S. elections. And Musk's ability to translate his economic power into political power is what offers him this very privileged and powerful position in the incoming administration. And that's going to benefit Musk, and the rest of us are likely to pay the price.
And Brendan, I think Open Secrets reported that about more than 40% of the total money raised by Trump came from just 10 individuals in the country. Have we ever experienced a presidency so beholden to such a small group of people?
This is unprecedented. It's certainly true that every election cycle since the 2010 Citizens United decision has been more expensive than the last. Democrats and Republicans have both embraced super PACs and embraced the mega donors that fund them. But Trump is taking this to another level. As you said, over 44% of the money raised to support Trump came from just 10 donors, and Musk being one of the top few. And you know, that's not something we've seen before. We've not seen that level of disproportionate spending from just a handful of wealthy billionaires.
So Brendan Fischer, if you can talk about Elon Musk's power right now, spent more than $277 million on getting Trump elected through his super PACs. and where he stands right now.
Right. Well, I think Rob Weissman described it very well. Musk has this, semi-formal position in the U.S. government. He has already used his formal and informal power to derail a bipartisan spending deal at the end of last year. His personal wealth has ballooned by over $170 billion in just the month following the election, with investors taking the view that his companies are going to do very well under a Trump administration, given that Musk has so much influence over that Trump administration. He's likely to continue to receive federal contracts, perhaps receive even more federal contracts. The Musk's companies that are heavily regulated or under criminal investigation are likely to receive a light touch under the Trump administration. And his power is now even going global. Musk has begun to meddle in European political affairs, and global leaders are taking that meddling seriously because of the perception or the reality that Musk has influence over the new president. So I think many global leaders are looking at statements from Musk and wondering whether it's actually a statement from Trump, or whether a Musk statement about global affairs is going to be adopted by the incoming Trump administration. And again, this is a power that is attributable to Musk's ability to pour over $250 million into the 2024 election, which is a direct result of the Supreme Court Citizens United decision.
And Brendan, you noted that that former President Biden used his farewell address to warn the country of the country veering toward an oligarchy. Yet what did Biden do during his presidency to restrain the influence of money in politics?
Not much. Biden's statements about the power of the growing oligarchy and the growing tech oligarchy were certainly welcome, and they were accurate. But Biden himself did very little during his administration to limit money's influence on politics. There were no executive orders to crack down on dark money or require contractors to disclose their political spending. And one of the most effective or direct things that a president can do to limit money's influence on politics, or to enforce the laws limiting money's influence on politics, is to appoint commissioners to the Federal Election Commission. And the one Democrat that Biden nominated to the Federal Election Commission actually sided with the Republicans in this key advisory opinion that came out last year that allowed super PACs to coordinate with campaigns on certain canvassing and other activities. And it's that advisory opinion that allowed Elon Musk's super PAC to take over some central campaign operations from the Trump campaign. It allowed the Trump campaign to outsource key campaign operations to this Musk-funded super PAC, which further amplified Musk's political influence. So, Biden's legacy in many ways on money and politics is one of deregulation. It's on his watch that the FEC has really accelerated this this deregulatory turn and has allowed even more money and even more unregulated money to flow into the U.S. political system.
A part of what President Biden said last week in his farewell address when warning about the dangers of what he called the tech industrial complex.
We see the same dangers, the concentration of technology, power, and wealth. His farewell address, President Eisenhower spoke of the dangers of the military-industrial complex. He warned us then about, and I quote, the potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power, end of quote. Six decades later, I'm equally concerned about the potential rise of a tech-industrial complex that could pose real dangers for our country as well.
For more on the growing alignment between Trump and Silicon Valley, we're joined from San Francisco by Becca Lewis. She's a postdoctoral scholar at Stanford University. Her research focuses on right-wing influence in Silicon Valley. Becca, welcome to Democracy Now! You just finished your PhD on this very subject. I think decades ago, people were associating Silicon Valley and big tech with certainly not the right and the far right. Can you talk about the change?
Yeah, that's right. Thank you so much for having me. What I found in my research is that even though it hasn't been part of our public understanding of Silicon Valley, there actually has been a really important right-wing strain in Silicon Valley for decades at this point. And a lot of what we're seeing right now is that coming to fruition, really reaching an apex rather than emerging out of nowhere.
And talk about those forces in the 1970s, 80s, 90s.
Yeah, so at that time, there was a lot of right-wing backlash against the gains of particularly feminism and fear around the breakdown of the nuclear family, or at least the perceived breakdown of the nuclear family. And there was a loose network of right-wing thinkers, writers, public intellectuals who came to see Silicon Valley as a space to restore the role of masculinity in the American economy through this ideal of entrepreneurship. And they really promoted entrepreneurs as preternaturally gifted men who should not be held to society's other standards, rules, or regulations. And this was at a time when women and people of color were entering, universities and institutions of higher learning at higher rates than ever before. And these groups of social reactionary men were promoting the idea that entrepreneurship could do away with all of that. You wouldn't need education anymore because the entrepreneurs would be the ones to save us.
There is a leader in this movement.
But Becca, also this whole issue of the Silicon Valley folks, for the most part, were not as involved in national politics until recent years. Does their shift to some degree reflect the fact that the Biden administration began to become more assertive in anti-monopoly and antitrust efforts against Silicon Valley?
Yes, absolutely. There certainly have been these reactionary strains within Silicon Valley, but you also have seen that, the Obama administration, for example, was very, very welcoming to Silicon Valley and fostering it. And so you saw a lot of folks within Silicon Valley working, really happily with the Obama administration. And I think that's partly where we started to get this public perception that Silicon Valley was actually left-wing, when in fact a lot of what was happening was just symbiosis and Silicon Valley being able to do what they wanted. Once they started facing pushback, there was a reaction against these more progressive forces and or regulatory forces at the very least. And now you see a wholehearted embrace of Trump with the hopes of deregulation.
Also, President Trump announced yesterday a $500 billion joint venture known as Stargate between OpenAI, SoftBank, and Oracle in order to invest in an artificial intelligence power infrastructure. Could you talk about that and Trump's efforts to rescind Biden's executive order on AI?
Yes, this was a really big statement that the Trump administration would be friendly, would be deregulatory, would do everything to help out the tech titans who are promoting AI above all else. This is where we could see really the coziness emerging, even more than all of the tech titans in the front row at the inauguration. And it's really telling that one of the tech titans who is working with Trump in this effort is Larry Ellison, who's been one of the biggest right-wing forces in Silicon Valley since the 1980s, and also who has been a longtime Trump loyalist.
Becca Lewis, Google, Meta, Apple all face antitrust lawsuits. Musk companies are under a number of investigations, reviews by federal agencies. As Trump's second term begins, does he have leverage over these influential tech leaders, or are they completely running the show? And the significance of not only, the head of Meta, Zuckerberg, and of course, Elon Musk, right? They're all ahead of the cabinet members or the proposed cabinet members at the inauguration. But the CEO of TikTok was there as well.
Yes, absolutely. Trump has leverage over them and they have leverage over him. I think you're seeing a symbiotic relationship, but one in which they realize that there's power that each can gain from the other. For Trump, he really benefits from getting to attach his name to what seems like the forward-thinking, next wave, innovative elements of Silicon Valley, whereas the tech titans themselves know that he actually holds the power around regulation and government intervention. And so you really are seeing them cozy up to each other in a way that is driven both by aligned interests, but also by mutual fear.
Becca Lewis, I want to thank you for being with us. Postdoctoral scholar at Stanford University, just finished her PhD, her current research focusing on right-wing influence in Silicon Valley. Thanks also to Robert Weissman of Public Citizen and Brendan Fisher of Documented. Brendan will also link to your new article in Rolling Stone, Blame the Supreme Court for Elon Musk's Power in Trump's Administration. Coming up, Ravi Ragbir is back. In the last days of President Biden's tenure as president, he pardoned the immigrant rights leader. Stay with us.
Desafiantes, ingobernables, no le tememos y no pararemos. Por nuestra liberación nos dedicamos, porque nuestros futuros están las vidas negras importan.
Las vidas negras importan.
Ningún ser humano es ilegal.
Ningún ser humano es ilegal.
Justicia reproductiva.
Justicia reproductiva.
Que viva Palestina.
Que viva Palestina.
Él no es mi presidente. Él no representa la voz de mi gente. Si están conmigo, pues digan presente. En Cristo no es mi presidente. No es
No Es Mi Presidente, Not My President by Taina Asili, a remix version of the same song from 2017 that was released Monday. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to a discussion of efforts to push back against the Trump administration's anti-immigrant agenda. The Department of Homeland Security said Tuesday it's allowing federal immigration agents to conduct raids at schools, houses of worship, and hospitals, ending a years-long policy that banned ICE agents from arresting people at these locations. This comes a day after President Trump signed a series of executive orders on Inauguration Day, which included declaring a national emergency at the southern border, launching mass raids and deportations, restricting federal funds from sanctuary cities, and ending birthright citizenship, which is protected by the U.S. Constitution's 14th Amendment. On Tuesday, a coalition of 24 Democratic-led states and cities filed a lawsuit in federal court to block Trump's executive order attempting to end birthright citizenship. For more, we're joined by three guests, three leading advocates for immigrant rights here in New York. Longtime immigrant rights advocate Ravi Ragbir is back in our studio. After nearly 20 years of fighting his own deportation, he was granted a pardon by President Biden on Sunday. a day before Biden left office. We're also joined by Amy Gottlieb, Ravi's wife and U.S. Migration Director for American Friends Service Committee, and Alina Das, lawyer and professor at New York University School of Law, where she is co-director of the NYU Immigrant Rights Clinic, part of Ravi's legal team. So we're going to go large on the issue of immigration in a moment, but I want to hear the moment that you heard. First of all, Ravi Ragbir, it was so hard for you to even speak to Fridays ago when you were here as you waited news in your own case. You're so busy always advocating for others. How did you find out you got a pardon?
That whole day on Saturday, and I come to Saturday because that's when we heard, I was in a funk, in a deep, very depressed, and I was lowering my expectations, saying we will never get it, we will never get it. And at nine o'clock in the night, we got a call from Melina, Amy and I, and Amy got the call and she put Alina on speaker. And every time we get a lot of the times when
Alina,
we get
your lawyer,
Alina Das, my lawyer. Usually when we get calls from Melina, it's like, oh my God, what's next? What is going to happen that we're going to have to be worried about? Alina was in tears because she had just gotten that call from the White House stating that her client, who is me, is going to get the pardon.
How did Alina talk about where you were when you got the call? You've worked so hard on this for so long.
Yes, well, Ravi has been working hard for the past 19 years fighting his deportation. I've been his lawyer for the last 17 years, and it was incredible. It was at home with my children when I got this call from a 202 number, ran upstairs to take it in quiet, and I really fell to my knees and sobbed.
What did they say?
They told me that my client would be getting a pardon, and they said that it was, you know, a credit to his fearless advocacy and the advocacy of so many who had spoken up for him over the years. And they acknowledged that we as an immigrant rights movement would be facing very hard times ahead. And I told the person from White House counsel that this news was the wind at our back.
Typically, what does the pardon do for him now in terms of his case?
So Ravi faced deportation based on a single criminal conviction that he received 24 years ago. And our federal immigration laws, which have been incredibly harsh for a very long period of time, did not give him a safety valve. They did not give an immigration judge the ability to consider his family ties, the hardship of deportation, his contributions to the community before ordering his deportation. So what federal law did recognize was that a full and unconditional pardon of his conviction would eliminate those immigration consequences. So that's what we've received now. And this will allow him to live without fear of deportation, to live freely after all these years.
Can I add to that? People have asked me how I feel, right? I am numb because after all those years of living under this, I am numb because I have always had to steel myself against what was going to happen. But right from the next day on Monday is the absence of worrying about what is going to happen. And that there's a certain amount of freedom, there's a certain amount of lightening of the load. I feel so light and so free because I don't have to think about that possibility. All I can think about is living my life working to stop what is happening to the thousands of families.
So let's talk about what's happening. There have been reports of imminent ICE raids across the country, in Chicago and New York, which are sanctuary cities. How do you want and expect New York City officials to respond, including Mayor Eric Adams? It's very complicated. He went down to Mar-a-Lago. He met privately with Trump ahead of his inauguration, met with Trump's so-called border czar, Tom Homan, in December. What do you want to see now? I mean, Amy, you now are celebrating your husband's freedom here. He won't be deported to Trinidad and Tobago. But how, for example, is AFSC preparing and the information that has to get out to people all over the country?
Yeah. So we're doing a lot of what every organization is doing right now, is really kind of doubling down to make sure that we are connecting with people who feel like they're at risk. There's Know Your Rights presentations happening everywhere all the time. You know, people are upping their information, but it can't just be that, right? Like, we also are building out organizing work. We're making sure that people who are willing, or perhaps people who are not at risk, are willing to put themselves out there to support people who are at risk. So we're working, you know, collectively with the American Friends Service Committee is a Quaker organization. So we're really connecting with Quaker meetings that have concerns about immigrants in their communities. We're also having a lot of conversations across the border. We have offices in Latin America, in El Salvador and Guatemala and Mexico. So we're seeing what's happening right now in Tijuana, San Diego in particular, and making sure that we're able to support people who have family members who might be facing deportation here. So it's a host of things. But I think the key thing we want to be really super careful about is to not let ourselves go down a road where we're completely overwhelmed and can't function, right? We have to stay centered. We have to be able to hear what's happening, realize what the law does. So we are so grateful for all of our partner organizations that are filing lawsuits immediately. But there also needs to be a buildup on the ground, that community support, because the truth is that with the best legal counsel in the world, which we have, you also need community. And that's how Ravi got his pardon. And that is a light for all of us. And I'll say that, you know, just on a call I was on last night to share the story about Ravi getting the pardon is it's a little bit of light and energy for people as we're facing all the things that the administration is saying they're going to do. So we have to really stay calm, stay grounded, know that as much as what they're saying is ugly and horrible and racist and frightening, that we are on the right side of history, and we're going to be. We have to stay there.
And I'd like to ask Alina, Trump issued an executive order on Monday that would restrict federal funds from sanctuary cities and potentially take legal action against them. What is your sense of the state laws and clashing now with a federal policy and how that's going to work out?
This is something that we saw during the first Trump administration as well. And states and localities were able to fight back because the Constitution does protect states from being interfered with by the federal government. And I think what people need to keep in mind is that sanctuary laws, as they're described, really are just about ensuring that cities and states are actually fulfilling their residents' constitutional rights. The cities and states are not allowed to just hold people waiting for the federal government to come and pick them up. Many of the laws that are being attacked by the Trump administration are simply a recognition of people's constitutional rights to be free and to require the federal government to have a judicial warrant before they come and arrest people or enter into private properties. These are very fundamental things. And I think we're seeing the Trump administration widen its circle of pain and suffering, coming after cities and states who are, again, just abiding by the law, coming after U.S. citizens to take away their birthright citizenship, coming after churches and schools. I mean, this is wrong, and we need people to continue to stand up and fight back and protect everyone's constitutional rights.
Juan, we're here in New York, a sanctuary city. You're in Chicago, which until recently, a few days ago, was, everyone thought, ground zero, the first place for immigration raids. And then inexplicably, the czar, immigration czar, border czar, as they call him, Homan, said because of media leaks, they're not going to attack Chicago first. But he was the one who said it publicly. It wasn't the media. What is the feeling in Chicago right now?
Yeah, and I think he got ticked off that the information leaked out about the mobilizations and the plans for Chicago. But no doubt all of these major cities will soon confront the onslaught of agents coming in to round people up. So it's only a question of days, really.
So when it comes to New York, I mean, it's more complicated because the mayor in Chicago is really standing up against Trump. But the mayor of New York, who's under indictment himself, maybe he's seeking a pardon, I don't know, Mayor Adams, met with Trump and Homan. What are you demanding of him, Amy Gottlieb, Ravi Ragbir?
So we don't. The way I frame it, I don't care what he does or what he doesn't do. It is what the people have to do in the community of New York City. The city council stands up for the members of the residents. You know, even though de Blasio was a so-called people's, but he wasn't in the situation as Adams, the NYPD still worked actively with ICE, right? They worked actively for my deportation in 2018. So, but what happened is everyone stood up, everyone stepped out. So people need to start connecting to the local organizations, the AFSC, any of the immigrant rights plus other groups.
Seconds.
Okay. So that we it is not what Mayor Adams have to do, what we have to do, Amy.
We're going to have to leave it there. Ravi Ragbir,